PFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Tonight, the phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. In some places, you might be hearing us on different frequencies, 89.5, I'm told, is one. Egberto, what are some of the other frequencies? Do you know?
Oh, I am supposed to know Galveston, 89.5, Goodrich Livingston, 90.3, and Huntsville, 91.8.
So in a sense, we are all over the radio dial. You see, that could be kind of cool.
But, Mike, there's something special. I don't know if you know about it.
What's that?
We're getting a 100,000-watt transmitter, but we need to have it delivered, so you guys need to go to kpft.org, click on that button to help us get with that Indiegogo thing to raise $20,000 to bring her on.
We are going to have one of those transmitters that if someone came in here and wanted to be mischievous, we could crank that baby up and broadcast into Mexico.
You've got that right.
That's what Wolfman Jack used to do at one point in his career. They had a Mexican radio station that would broadcast at 100,000 watts. It would blot out stations all over the U.S. Southwest. So, in a sense, the Mexicans came back. Okay, open forum, open lines, 713-526-5738. You can bring up any topic you want. I've got several things that I can talk about. One of the things I mentioned last week, and I don't know if we didn't get much response or if we were having control board issues and people were getting cut off, and if so, I apologize. But I raised the topic, is trans the new gay? I say that in the sense of media attention. So for a few years, while gay people were still kind of feeling excluded and discriminated against, and I'm not saying that they don't anymore, but much, much more so, where a lot of gay people, lesbians, homosexual men, felt that they needed to hide themselves, hide who they were. And now it's like, oh, you're gay. Cool. Shows all over the place. They have gay love arcs. They have gay key characters. So, you know, it's like, gay? Eh. And I'm thinking that trans, when I say trans is the new gay, I'm thinking in terms of media attention. All of a sudden, because of Caitlyn Jenner, the question of what is transgender? What does that mean? How is it different from gay? How is it different from transvestite? Why do they want to use the opposite sex bathroom? What does that mean to the people that are actually using, born with the gender of the opposite sex bathroom? So a lot of questions. I am not equipped personally to answer them, but I think it raises a really worthwhile and useful discussion topic and maybe a bit of a meme, is trans the new gay? So we can talk about that. That's one topic I wanted to raise, 713-526-5738. The other one is just nutsy, the Middle East. You know, they talk about you can't tell the players without a scorecard. I don't think you have enough scorecards to tell the players in the Middle East. So you've got ISIS, variously known as ISIL and Daesh and maybe some other terms. And they are essentially what you would call, and I get a little hooked up on the distinction, either they are a millennial or Malarian belief system. That is to say, when you think about how many countries and ethnic groups they're fighting the Syrians and Iraqis, of course. They're fighting the Kurds, which technically are Syrians and Iraqis, except they're technically Kurds. They're fighting the Jordanians. They're fighting the United States. They're fighting Egypt. They're fighting, you've got individuals, pilots and such from Kuwait. They've got now actions that they're taking in Libya. And there's fighting going on in Yemen. And you've got the United States supporting the anti-Iranian side in Yemen. And you've got the United States fighting, essentially coordinating with Iran in Iraq. It's nutsy. It's totally insane. The Middle East melee is what I'm calling it. War insanity. And now the Turks have joined in, just to make it more interesting, because it wasn't interesting enough. So now the Turks are not only bombing ISIS targets, and by the way, the Turks have also had firing exchanges with actual Syrian military, but now the Turks are actually bombing targets in Syria, ISIS targets in Syria, and they're also bombing the Kurds. And the Kurds, of course, have been one of the best allies for the West in terms of their enthusiasm, their toughness, their willingness to take the fight to the enemy. And now they're fighting the Turks and ISIS. I mean, I got to tell you, when you talk about the enemy of my enemy is my friend, maybe the friend of my friend is my enemy. I mean, literally, this is insane. And if I actually put a couple of links on tonight's show announcement, one of them from Wikipedia shows the extent of the regional involvement in this conflict. And when you look at it, it really is a Middle Eastern war. It's not just a war in Iraq and Syria. It's not just ISIS. But when you look at it, there's so much interconnection. You've got fighting going on in the Sinai Peninsula between Egyptian military and ISIS or Al-Qaeda-related groups. You've got ISIS affiliates in Libya. You've got an ISIS affiliate allegedly in Nigeria. You've got fighting going on in Yemen between the Iranian-backed Houthis and the Western-backed Saudis. I mean, you can't even sort this out. And, you know, what's interesting, I sort of do this all as a preface. What's interesting to me is that in some ways, and I know there are going to be people that will take offense at this, and, you know, we can discuss it, but in some ways, ISIS is not that different from some millennial evangelist Christians. Now, there is very strong support for the most part for Israel in the United States government. And of course, what's interesting is most of these supporters are not Jewish. They don't have, let's say in very broad terms, a familial or ethnic connection to Israel, like potentially someone like myself. A lot of the Christian support for Israel is because the last days scenario, the second coming, the epiphany, depends on the existence of the state of Israel as a state of Israel. For many Christians, and I'm not saying for all, but there is a portion of the Christian community in the United States and in the United States government that supports Israel not because it's a democracy, not because they feel the Jews need a homeland after the disaster, the tragedy, the horror of the Holocaust. There are those people, but there are people that support Israel because the second coming and the Armageddon and the Epiphany, they feel, by biblical prophecy, cannot come true unless there is a state of Israel. It can't just happen in the territory that has been Israel. There has to be a state of Israel. So how different is ISIS? Well, if you look at ISIS as simply wanting to conquer territory and become a fundamentalist Muslim state. And I paused because, you know, it's like fundamentalist Muslim. Well, you know, they're kind of Sunni, but they're kind of not. It's almost like a more primitive version of Sunni. So a lot of Sunnis, while they kind of don't hate them, get scared of them. Very, very complicated stuff. But they are also, in a sense, a millenarist organization. And I once read a really lengthy, interesting article, and it's posted as a link back on one of my older shows, that compared ISIS's strategy to not an imperialist strategy, not a nationalist strategy, but in fact a millennialist strategy, that they believe that holding certain territory, they don't even have to win in military terms, perhaps, according to their core ideology. But by involving the entire world in this battle, in this region, where Armageddon or the Muslim equivalent is, and I'm not sure if they're the same, by getting the entire world involved in this battle, in a sense, they are bringing on the, they're not going to call it the second coming, but the Muslim equivalent, essentially, of the second coming, perhaps of the prophet, of the second coming, or of the coming of the epiphany, the destruction of the infidels of the world, the purification of the world. I mean, they have, in many ways, a very, very close religious connection, equivalency, if you will, to a similar doctrine within certain sects of the Christian religion. It's really very, very interesting. You know, it's like there's nothing new under the sun. We keep reinventing the same good and bad things from generation to generation, from lifetime to lifetime. We just keep repeating ourselves. I sometimes do that. Open forum. This is obviously a topic ripe for discussion, but you can talk about anything you want. 713-526-5738. I'm going to do a little early ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm Mike Koenig. Egberto Willis is on the control board, answering phones as we speak. And Egberto has his own show, Thursdays at 3 p.m., Politics Done Right. Here I do politics okay. Sometimes I don't do politics at all. Occasionally I put my toes into an area like religion, which I'm not as knowledgeable about perhaps as I ought to be. 713-526-5738. Okay, another topic, and man, the Middle East, you could probably take up an hour just fumfering about the Middle East right now. Another topic that's kind of interesting. What is the definition of a small business exactly? You know, a number of years ago, I guess maybe 20, 30 years ago, maybe more like 20, companies that wanted limited liability started going from being corporations, either chapter, subchapter S or I think maybe subchapter C, going into LLPs, limited liability partnerships. It has only just recently occurred to me. I mean, I was very curious about the reason for that because it seemed like everyone is saying, oh, there are just some legal technicalities. It's basically corporation, LLP, LLC, basically the same thing. But you always have to wonder why. After hearing different things about the blurring of what constitutes a small business, when I was a younger person, a small business, a medium-sized business, and a large business or a big business were three basic classifications. And I think that a small business was like sales of over of under $50 or $100 million a year. And a medium-sized business was like sales between $100 million and $500 million a year. And a big business was like sales over $500 million a year, or something like that. There was a very clear categorization. And now it seems that you have people like the Koch brothers and Carl Icahn and various other big investors. And somehow when you dig down into small businesses, you find that they are part owners in an LLC or an LLP. And those businesses, because they are distinct, I'll use the term loosely, corporate entities, that these multi-billionaires who own multi-billion dollar companies or run them, they become the beneficiaries of policies for small business in terms of small business loans, small business access, small business government assistance. because they are a partner, quote unquote, in a small business, quote unquote. But really, they're billionaires and they don't need that kind of aid and assistance. So if it were a corporation, the corporation itself would be judged by what the level of business is, and they would be shareholders. But because of a limited liability corporation, limited liability partnership, where you're not actually a stockholder, you're a member, it's subtly different. All of a sudden, these multi-billionaires get government largesse. It's really intriguing. If there is someone out there who can help to clarify that, I would love to have them call 713-526-5738. Open lines. We do have someone on the line, Gary. My old friend, you're on the air. How you doing tonight? I don't think you're on the air. I don't see him red. Now he's red. You're on the air, Gary. How you doing?
I'm here, Mike. How are you doing?
Okay, so...
All right, so you're delving into eschatology.
Okay.
You know what that is?
I think so.
Okay, and the prophecies of the end times,
right,
and the Shias and the Sunnis, and the Jews and the Christians.
Yep.
And do you believe in magic?
I believe...
Do you believe in magic? Why are you talking about these preposterous ancient ideas
that
are basically no more than genetics, and we can figure out...
It doesn't always come back to DNA, Gary, but I'll tell you...
It does.
I'll tell you why I'm talking about it.
No, I'm right. You know I'm right.
I know you're right on some aspects of it. Let me tell you why I'm talking about it. I'm not talking about it because I believe in magic. I'm not even talking about it because I believe in religion.
Well, I know that.
Personally.
But what I'm saying
no,
is...
No, 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 no. Hold on, hold on. Let me finish. The reason I'm saying it is it doesn't matter if I believe it, and it doesn't matter if you believe it. It only matters if they believe it. And if they believe it... You know, I've said this many times about many people with many opinions, whether they're white supremacists or racists or, you know, whatever they're anti-gay. It doesn't matter if you agree with them, but it helps to get inside their heads because you have to live in the same world with them, and you have to either accept them or you have to, in the case of ISIS going around beheading and assassinating people, you have to destroy them. But you have to exist with them, and that you have to begin with understanding of what's in their head.
Well, here's why I called.
Okay.
Because you made a comment about the events occurring these days in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
But has it ever, ever been different? I mean, let's go back 100 years. Okay, let's go back back to the Ottoman Empire. Let's go back to the Armenian massacre. Let's go back to the massacre of the American native peoples. Let's go back to the taking over South America, the Spanish and the French. And it's never been different, ever, has it?
But
aren't humans? Yeah. Well, we used to ride horses with swords, and now we use AK-47s, but we're still doing the same thing,
okay,
aren't we?
But, and again, in many places, many parts, I agree with you. I don't always agree quite with your angle, but I often agree with you in essence. But here's the thing. If you've listened to my show for a long time, and I think you have, you've heard me talk about my thinking that there really wasn't a First World War and a Second World War and subsequent related wars. I actually think that the First World War was the beginning of what will ultimately historically be looked at as a 100-year conflict, maybe more. Because what happened in the First World War, and I bring it up because you did, it changed the political face of the earth. You had the destruction of empires hundreds of years old, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the German Empire, which wasn't hundreds of years old, but you had the Germanic states, and... Then you had this artificial, and you and I have talked about this, we had this artificial political breakup of the Ottoman Empire. The British got this, and the French got that, and the Germans and Italians got a little. And the borders, as we've discussed, were completely arbitrary.
You need to go back further.
Well...
I don't want to
go back further because I want to keep it in the context of modern history rather than ancient history.
All right, well, let's go back to 10,000 BC when the Jews were slaves in Egypt, and then they went to Israel, and then you have to remember all the controversies occurring today in Burma and China and et cetera are a result of issues that have been going on for thousands of years.
I totally agree.
Okay,
but I want to keep this politically in the context of modern times. The Ottoman Empire, in its way, imposed order on this region, and it is one of the reasons why Turkey has been reluctant to get involved, because historically they were considered imperialists and oppressors. And if they suddenly start coming back in, you're going to have in the region flashbacks to the Ottoman Empire, and that can have all kinds of unintended consequences.
Oh, except that they're members of NATO. Hello?
Yeah, they haven't been such great members of NATO.
They have an obligation to assist their NATO allies?
Well, they do under some circumstances. They are obligated to help NATO allies who are attacked.
But boy, did they screw up attacking the Kurds. Look what they did.
Oh, my Lord.
You know, I want to hear you talk. I'm going to leave now.
All right. I appreciate that,
Thanks
Gary.
A
Thanks
lot,
so
Mike.
Much for calling. Open lines, 713-526-5738. The Kurds. The Kurds, in some ways, are like the Jews. I gave a station ID 7 minutes ago. Yeah, I gave it at 9:12. I gave an early station ID. I can give another station ID. I'm not against it. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Just to get back onto Egberto's topic, we are getting a new transmitter, maximum transmission of 100 freaking thousand watts. We can broadcast to Canada if we want the FCC on our butts. We're not going to broadcast into Canada. Their loss. So you can go to kpft.org. You can click on the tip jar. You can make a contribution. You can always make contributions to KPFT. We'll never say no. There are also ways of doing things like contributing cars, boats, things that you've been maybe trying to sell, or they've been taking up space in your garage or your driveway or storage or whatever. You can take the tax deduction because we're a 503. I always get this mixed up. 501c3. I can never get all those numbers and letters straight. 501c3, nonprofit organization. So whatever you donate is tax deductible. I sometimes jokingly say the more you give, the more you save, because it's a bigger tax deduction. And starting next week, for I think a couple of weeks, we're now going to be going back into, is it only 1 week, Egberto? Only one? We'll see. But we're going to be starting to do some fundraising. So at that point, you'll be able to call and make your contribution. But you can start early and go to the tip jar, kpft.org. Going back to the Kurds, what Gary's comment, you know, in some ways, the Kurds have a lot in common with the Jews. The Jews had a nation thousands of years ago. They were conquered. They were they either were distributed or emigrated to many parts of the world, what is called the diaspora. I don't know that the Kurds have had a diaspora. There are other groups that are considered to have them, the Irish in some ways, although they have a nation, the Norwegians. You have more Irish in the United States than Ireland. I think you have more Swedes and Norwegians in the United States than in Sweden and Norway. You've got more Jews in the United States, I think, than Israel. But the Kurds have never had a nation in history. At least thousands of years ago, you had the Kingdom of Israel. As far as I know, the Kurds have never had a nation. So they've always either been part of an empire or divided among empires. And I would say among the various groups, from an American perspective, my American perspective, I would say the Kurds have probably been the most effective allies of the United States after Israel in that part of the world, certainly in the current war going on, because the Israelis have been, for obvious reasons, trying to stay away from it. But in terms of physical involvement, combat, politics, strategy, engagement, the Kurds, in many ways, have been the best and most effective allies of the United States. And the only reason the United States has not given them more support is because technically the Kurds, on one hand, are part of Syria, on the other hand, are sort of a province within Iraq, and to give them direct aid would be to essentially to sort of recognize them as an independent entity from the Iraqi government, which the United States is not prepared to do. But we find ways. We find ways. Politics, very devious stuff. And now, We have been wanting to get the Turks involved. We've been wanting to use Turkish air bases because they're so much closer to the targets that you can effectively multiply your force by two or three times because you can fly that many more flights. They hit their targets that much more quickly. So it's important. And I apparently am not pronouncing this right, but Incirlik, the NATO air base in Turkey, and I think that's not the correct pronunciation, but it's the only one I know. So now they can use that. It's like 500 miles closer. It's like two-thirds closer to the targets that the United States and its allies have been hitting. There has been a truce between the Turkish Kurds and the Turkish government. The Turkish Kurds want autonomy or independence. You've got Syrian Kurds that have been wanting the same thing. You've got Iraqi Kurds that have been wanting the same thing. You've got Iranian Kurds that have been wanting the same thing. All of these different Kurdish groups divided among various borders, some artificial, some historical, have been wanting their own country, which is why I've been seeing so much cooperation between the Syrian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds. Well, to make a long story a little bit shorter, we wanted to get the Turks involved, and now the Turks are involved. They're letting NATO use bases inside Turkey. They're hitting ISIS targets with their own air force. Oh, and by the way, they're bombing the Kurds. So our ally, I mean, you talk about the enemy of your enemy is your friend, and sometimes the friend of your friend is your enemy. And sometimes the enemy of your friend is your enemy, and the friend of your enemy is your friend. Who can figure it out? So now we've got the Kurds, who we are supporting, not as nations, but as an effective fighting force. We've got the Kurds that we're supporting being bombed by the Turks, who are in NATO, who are our treaty allies. But the Turks are also bombing ISIS, and the Kurds are also fighting ISIS. What a mess. What a mess. Now, I have said a number of times, I am on the record as being against border changes. I am on the record as being against, in principle, national fragmentation. I think that the outcomes of such things are invariably messy and bloody and historically, in historical terms, temporary. But I really have to feel like the Kurds have earned themselves a country. Where that country would be, it wouldn't be in Iran because that would involve a civil war in Iran or an insurgency. And it wouldn't be in Turkey because I'm really against the notion of breaking up countries. But I think that given the effective dissolution of the Iraqi and Syrian nations, which are artificial creations of the victorious allies after the First World War anyway, given the fact that the borders have been erased in many ways, I think that there is a place, there ought to be a place for the Kurds to call a nation. That would make the Turks really unhappy and the Iranians really unhappy, not to mention that it would make many Syrians and Iraqis really unhappy. But I think that you can make a geopolitical and historical and ethnic argument for looking at those places and through negotiations at some point, setting up essentially a Kurdish homeland. That's what I think. Egberto, got anything on this? Oh, and you know, station ID, because we're at the bottom of the hour, you're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Egberto Willis has his own show Thursdays at 3 p.m. Politics done right here. Well, I don't know what the heck we do. What do you got?
Well, it concerns me when you said they deserve a nation, because assuming that they deserve a nation, from whose land would you carve their nation?
Syria and Iraq.
Under what pretext?
On the basis that, for the most part, the governments there have collapsed. They really don't have effective territorial control except in theory, and that ISIS has effectively erased the borders between them. And I think that that puts everything up in play. And that's why I'm against it in terms of taking territory from Iraq or Iran. But I think in Turkey or Iran. But I think when you talk about Syria and Iraq, those countries have so effectively fallen apart politically that I think it actually is not unreasonable to think of them having their own territory within that geography.
And who should guarantee that territory for them?
It's it's going to have to be negotiated. At some point, there's going to have to be negotiation if that's to happen. You can't take it by force of arms, or all you're going to have is continuing regional war. But I think there are going to be realities on the ground. You know, at some point after the 1967 war, the Israelis had the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Sinai Peninsula. That was reality on the ground. The Sinai Peninsula was still part of Egypt, technically. And the West Bank at that time was still part of Jordan, technically. Jordan later renounced the West Bank as territory. And the Golan Heights is still part of Syria, technically, because there have never been treaties that have established any other reality. Eventually, there was a treaty between Israel and Egypt that eventually returned the entire Sinai Peninsula to Egypt. There will have to be treaties. There will have to be political settlements at some point among either all the parties involved or the victorious parties, as the case may be. There will have to be negotiations. But I think that the Kurds, through their history, through their willingness and ability to effectively fight, their political constancy, if you will, the fact that they don't keep changing sides, you know, they're kind of consistent. I know that they have the terrorist organization. It's kind of like Sinn Féin in Ireland, where you had the political arm and the military wing. I get that. It's all very, very complicated, which is why I think it's going to have to be politically settled at some point in this process to end what I have come to term this 100 or 120-year war that started in 1914.
Well, you know, I am not I'm not politically competent enough in the history of the region to say much, but I can say one thing.
Okay.
And that is, I just think we need to stay out of those type of things. I mean, the West has already done enough damage to the way they repartitioned both Africa and the Middle East.
100 years ago.
Right. I think it is, you know, they should get out, let folks decide what borders they want to do. But right now, as it is, we want to control what's the possibility, who's the possibility, and all that.
We want to control the outcomes.
Right. And I'm saying, no, let the outcomes be controlled by those people that are going to be there.
And I am coming around to that point of view. You know, we had a policy of containment for the Soviet Union after 1917, particularly after 1945. We had a policy of containment, which from a historical geopolitical sense can be said to have worked. The Soviet Union collapsed. I think that it may be time, and of course oil is the big complicating factor, but I think that in some way we have to think of a policy of containment. Maybe it needs to be like Star Trek's Prime Directive, where we don't get involved in the natural evolution of a people and a political process. We just kind of keep hands off to the extent we can, as long as the Klingons don't get involved, you know? I mean, when you want to use that metaphor, you have to say, as long as it doesn't become a contested area with strategic significance, you try to keep hands off. And I think maybe we need to try to look at this part of the world from that perspective. It is so messy. We'll never sort it out. We'll never be able to pick a side that we can rely on. The Saudis are an artificial nation that's less than 100 years old that was essentially allowed to exist, allowed to create itself due to Western and particularly U.S. policy after World War I. Gary is back. All right, hold on. Let Egberto say his piece, and then we'll get back to Gary.
Yeah.
We do have open lines here, folks. 713-526-5738. It doesn't have to be a three-way conversation between me, Egberto, and Gary.
Look, we are – let me just say this. America, we are playing into the game. We are pawns in the game. Every single American sans the plutocracy, sans the big wheel, sans the oligarchs and the people who run the industries, they play this checker game, and we all play along with it. We are self-sufficient as Americans if we really want to be. We don't have to fight wars. We don't have to control the seas. We don't have to control any one of these things. We're doing it for the benefit of the benefit of the few. And until we learn that, you know, we the peons will continue to allow these folks to tell us what needs to be done.
Are you saying you're an isolationist?
And
do you think that isolationism is a practical, potentially functional policy?
To the extent that I am an isolationist within the context of the actually I don't want to specifically call myself an isolationist.
Because that is the policy stand you were taking.
But I'm pretty darn close to an isolationist.
Okay,
yes.
So what would your semi-isolationist policy look like in broad terms?
First of all, the first thing I would try to do is work on self-sufficiency in the country, which we have the natural resources.
We've exported a lot of our industrial self-sufficiency.
We have the resources to be self-sufficient. So we can rebuild our economy on self-sufficiency. The problem with rebuilding the economy on self-sufficiency is that resources would have to be shared broadly. And the problem that we have is we don't want to share resources broadly. In fact, what we have now is a result of not having shared resources, you know, broadly.
Okay, so now are you talking communism, socialism, or something else?
No, I get those words people love to throw.
I'm not accusing.
Right.
I'm trying to
clarify. I am for equitable distribution of...
By what means is the question. I mean, socialism is one way of doing that. Communism is another way of doing that. Capitalism and supply and demand is another way of doing that, and then there are mixtures of all those
things.
And
what I'm saying is that everything that you just named is nothing but a tool. And what we have here is a predominance of capitalism as the tool. And using the predominance of capitalism as the tool that we've instituted in America, we've created what the spoils are of having that be the maximal part of the deal. One step further, we are also, America currently is a socialist country as well. Social Security, Medicare, all these guys are.
It's a capitalist country with what do they call it? Deniability of socialism.
Right, and the reality is, like I wrote in a blog post yesterday when I was describing Bernie Sanders, what we should be concerned about is every free country right now, every democracy right now has some gradation of socialism. Some work better than
and
others.
Some countries admit to it more than others.
And we
our country does not like to admit to anything being socialistic, even down to public schools.
And the reason we don't want to do it is because we realize that certain things are better done when we're doing it in a collective manner.
Collective defense. And we don't go to each state and say, "Well, you help us fight this war." All the states are in.
But there's a problem with collective defense. When we talk collective defense, even that we try to capitalize. In other words, we go to war in Iraq, and instead of having our soldiers serve meals that will cost, in effect, $2 or $3 per meal or less,
it has to be done by a private provider.
It's done by a private provider, which charges $30 to $40, and somehow we say that is more efficient. A lot of times, the capitalist type of private enterprise is actually what I call an expense. It's not effective.
I will tell you what I understand is part of the defense for privatizing certain functions that intuitively you would think would be done by other military personnel, like food service. This is the rationale. I'm not saying I agree with it or not. If you had military personnel serving food, those military personnel then become eligible for military benefits to the end of their lives. So the upfront cost seems ridiculous, but the back end cost is much cheaper because they are not veterans. They don't get veterans benefits, veterans medical, veterans retirement. They don't get combat pay. They don't get because they're private contractors.
And that is a big lie.
It's not a lie.
No,
it's,
it is.
It's a tool. It's a tool. But essentially what the U.S. government is doing is shifting any responsibility for those providers to the private corporations. Now, they may get screwed by the private corporations, but from the U.S. government perspective, that is the rationale.
But it's
it may be right or wrong.
But what I'm saying is this. There is nothing that stops the federal government from saying, this will be military, this will be civil service, this would be something else, if they so choose to do. In other words, when we're at war, we could create an entity that is government-based, that is nonprofit, to serve the military. There are a lot of ways around that you can take the, because profit becomes an inefficiency in the military. It's an inefficiency that all taxpayers pay for. In other words, it's a transfer of wealth for war.
There has always been.
I understand that, but what I'm saying,
not just for us.
Exactly, but what I'm saying if we want to be honest with ourselves when we talk about the size of defense budgets, the size of all these other programs, if we took the profit motive out of several of these programs, it would be that much cheaper. And that is something that nobody wants to really admit to. They forget basic arithmetic. But you want Gary to, I don't want to.
Yeah, well, Gary's had his turn. But sure, go ahead. Put Gary
on. All right, let's go. Gary, you're hot.
Gary, again.
I'm calling because nobody else will.
I know. Isn't that disappointing?
You're kind of lonely. And
yeah.
I'm actually calling about something you said 45 minutes ago, but I wanted to point out that you suggested that the groups in the Middle East, Shia, Sunni, Kurds, Turkmenistan, they should
all work out
their problems and redefine their borders. So were you proposing like a bloodbath?
I don't think I have to propose it. I think they're doing fine by themselves. I think, though, that at the end of the
right?
I think at the end of the bloodbath, and at some point, every warfare exhausts the participants.
But now, some of these tribal issues have been going on for years.
You know, I agree, but you see, hold on. I'll let you go on in a second. But
do you know why there's 48 countries in Europe?
Because they're all tribes and they
couldn't
get along.
Because nobody could get along with anybody.
I totally
now,
get
what's
that.
What's going to happen with the Kurds and the Turks and the Sunnis and the Shiites? And, you know, don't you see it's going to be, there has to be some kind of imposed order by either the United Nations or NATO or somebody, or it's just going to be like Al-Shabaab all over again.
I think you raise a very good point, and again, it's something we've talked about. The West keeps talking about spreading democracy, but when you look at the results in certain parts of the world, and we're talking about the Middle East, you sometimes have to then wonder, okay, democracy in principle is a good thing, and democracy in principle does help to release the pressure of groups that have different or disparate interests. But are there parts of the world where our understanding of democracy creates the potential for chaos and you need something like a strong man, perhaps what they would call the strong president version of democracy?
Reality has answered that question, hasn't it?
Well, I mean, yes and no.
Saddam Hussein answered that question.
Well, he did.
Right.
I mean, every tyrant.
He, and you can name the Shah of Iran, and you can name the president of Egypt, and you can find us going all the way back through history.
Of course, but
if you didn't have somebody keeping the disparate groups from killing each other by threat of death, then you had disparate groups killing each other.
I know you're raising points, and I would really like to try to respond to them as you raise them, because then you go on, and I can't discuss
I'm
them
sorry.
Anymore. That's okay. We can do that. We can work with that as long as I get to
hear you. Don't listen to me.
Oh no, you make some really interesting points, but there are places where I'd like to respond if we can kind of get in there. What you're saying, I mean, essentially you're agreeing with me in part, but I think that there is a place for a kind of democratic process that has also a central strongman form of government. But we have to invent a new kind of democracy for parts of the world like this. A new kind of democracy that on the one hand addresses the concerns of different ethnic and political and religious groups, while at the same time keeping a lid on things so they don't kill each other.
Well, I think in July, Al-Assad of Egypt of Syria was reelected as the president of Syria.
I think it was 100% of the vote, wasn't it?
Oh, wait.
Because everybody loves
him.
The
point is, he's obviously a strong man, and his father was. The family has been just like in England. Same family for 500 years.
No, actually, it's actually been for more like a couple of years. They had to import a German royalty at some point.
But the point is that they will not relinquish power, but they claim to be a democracy, and they have a popular vote. And, yeah, if you don't vote, they cut your head off. I don't know.
But I mean, I think that's... Go ahead, and then I'll make my point.
Well, you're making all your comments, observations, and understandings from the point of, through the goggles, the beer goggles, of American democracy. But not everybody in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, it actually sees things in the same way.
But if you've been listening to me, I've been saying precisely the opposite. I've been saying that the West has been pushing a Western form of democracy onto these countries, and I've been the one saying maybe we need a different form of democracy that on the one hand allows different political interests to vent and to some extent satisfy their needs and wants, while having some kind of a strong man at the top to keep everybody from killing each other when there's a disagreement.
That's exactly true.
And replacing him peacefully, which is the point of democracy, to replace your leader peacefully after a reasonable time.
You're absolutely correct, and that comment by you is the reason I called.
Okay, well, thank you.
And we agree.
Well, yeah.
Damn, this ain't no fun.
We don't really fundamentally disagree when you call, Gary. We disagree in details.
You just don't believe in DNA, so what can I tell you?
I do believe in DNA, just not to the extent that you do. So in a sense, we sort of agree on the DNA thing, but I also believe that nature and environment have a place in human behavior.
I can't argue with that.
Okay, then we agree. So,
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you, Gary, for calling back. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm glad that we have Gary on tap. It's like he's the on-deck caller, just in case, you know, I'm boring people out there, or I'm saying something so incredibly fascinating that they don't need to contribute anything.
I think it's because you need to speak to something like Trump. Or Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
I mean, I can talk about Trump, too, but, you know, why? Bernie Sanders, getting back to the topic of communism, socialism, capitalism, where the boundaries are, and the United States being a country in denial about the socialist things that we do, we don't want to call them socialism. Bernie Sanders, I think, whatever happens with his candidacy, whether he flames out, whether he becomes the vice presidential nominee, whether he becomes the presidential nominee or goes back to Vermont, I think that one of the most useful things that he can do, and I'm going to use an interesting terminology here, I think he can bring socialism out of the closet.
I couldn't agree with you more, and it's great to hear you say something like that.
Well,
I actually saw Bernie Sanders last week.
Oh, man, I would have loved to have been there.
I was at Netroots when he was out there, and he had a great speech. Of course, he was Black Lives Matter kind of interrupted him for a while, and justifiably, I must add, although a lot of people disagreed. But then he got on to his message, and his message was what it has always been. But more importantly, his message is becoming quite a bit clearer, and as it becomes clearer, more Americans are liking it.
Open lines, 713-526-5738. Open forum, although we seem to have sort of, as we often do, focused in certain areas. Let me ask you, the Bernie Sanders at Netroots, the media, they basically put a lot of emphasis on the Black Lives Matter interruption of Bernie Sanders' appearance. I have not heard anything about what happened afterward. They pretty much give the impression, without saying so, that that was the end of his appearance. You're saying...
No, listen. First of all, Bernie Sanders...
Tell me about what he did after that, how he resolved that and was able to go on.
Well, actually, believe it or not, Black Lives Matter gave... there's a call. Let me get that first.
Sure. Okay, so we're going to have to be on tenterhooks what Egberto's opinion was on that. I think Bernie Sanders is serving an incredibly useful function on several different levels. I think he's taking socialism out of the closet. I think because he's been a long-serving politician as a mayor, as a senator, as a governor. Was he a governor? Was Bernie Sanders ever a governor? I know he was a senator.
I think he was
in the House.
Yeah, but let me just say, going back to your question originally, Bernie Sanders was given ample time to give his speech. Black Matters wanted him to bring up the problem, an existential problem to many in the black community as far as their relationships with the justice system. And unfortunately, while he agreed with the Black Lives Matter context context. He didn't quite address it immediately, and they held him to task for that. But other than that, Bernie's message was loved, even in that room. There was a bit of ruckus. That night, Bernie appeared downstairs in front of 11,000-plus people with a new message that included the social justice component. He then went to Dallas on Sunday and Houston on Sunday. When I flew back on Sunday, I also went to the stuff that he gave on Sunday in Houston. And his message had been modified to be more inclusive, and that was actually...
He's learning as he goes.
And what I'm saying is what campaigns are all about.
Right.
I love the guy because he has been the most nimble candidate running to date.
I think that he has been the most interesting and historically may end up being the most significant candidate.
I agree.
I agree
with you.
Okay, Cheryl. Yeah. Cheryl, welcome to Think Wing Radio. You're on the air. How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I struggle with this idea of imposing democracy. I think that democracy is something that people in a state raise up and demand for themselves. And I struggle with the efficacy of any group, United Nations or United States, trying to impose that on the Middle East. In fact, I think it fuels the fires of the sectarianism in that area.
Well, you know, along the lines of what you're saying, what's the group in Gaza? Hezbollah's in Lebanon. What's the group in Hamas?
Mm-hmm.
Hamas, I mean, the Bush administration imposed a Palestinian election, and that's how Hamas took over Gaza. So it's like, be careful what you wish for. I agree with you, but when you look at the spectrum that we've had so far, you've had the effort to impose Western-style democracy as opposed to tyrannical strongmen who are willing to use the so-called iron fist method of control, shooting people down, in the case of Saddam Hussein, nerve gassing Kurdish villages. So there needs to be something between those two extremes, but I am increasingly agreeing with people who feel that Western-style democracy is not the model that they can use.
I really need to say this, and I want to say it in the right context. We must be careful, I think, of how we refer to foreign leaders as tyrannical, because our government claimed they're tyrannical. I'm not defending these guys at all, because I simply don't know. What I try to say is I am not going to take at face value that my CIA tells me that some leader is tyrannical, because I think many times that is actually used to get us engaged in wars and otherwise that
cause,
we shouldn't.
Right. In a cause that's for other reasons.
Exactly.
So, yeah. You know, and I go back to the same thing, whether, you know, they have a person gassing people. I think one point was made by someone earlier that, you know, war will burn itself out. The people will tire up.
Eventually,
war
exhausts the participants.
Isn't really the reason that we've had to get involved in the Middle East as we have is because of our oil interest there?
I think that ultimately is the reason, yeah.
And then why do we need, when we have a surplus here, should we focus on being able to sell our oil overseas and focus on our own success and let the people there focus on their own destiny, not because we don't care, but because only the people of a state can rise up and demand democracy for themselves if they decide that's what they want.
Well, the United States has, I don't think the United States was energy independent since the 1950s, somewhere in the 1950s.
But that is by choice.
No, that is because we are consuming more than we produce.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's by choice.
Okay, it's you can say it's by choice. Let's just say it's the fact. I don't want to get into the reasons why. It just is.
But, I mean, it's still a choice. We could choose not to be that way, but we choose to be that way.
But for the last half century, we haven't chosen that, okay? Jimmy Carter, who gets a terribly bad rap.
Well, that's a big problem, that we haven't chosen that. I mean, we focus on trying to interfere in other people's affairs for our own prurient interests when we should be focusing on energy independence in ways that we can without interfering in other areas, in other people's interests, in their business.
But
I mean, that's the problem.
But
that's the problem. It's not up to us. We're not God. We can't impose democracy or a tyrant or anybody on another group of people. It's not our business.
Well, can't is different from shouldn't. You know, I think that we've proven we can. The question is whether we should. And I
we
think
should not.
We should not.
We would not want it done to us here.
That's true. But, of course, most nations in their geopolitics don't think that way going all the way back in history. I mean, nations do what they consider to be in their interest, rightly or wrongly.
Exactly.
But I think that when you look, one of the things, you know, I never thought that Jimmy Carter was a great president, but he absolutely doesn't deserve the bad rap he's gotten historically because of the memes put out by Republicans. Yes, the Desert One rescue attempt of the Iranian hostages failed. That was a bold and ultimately catastrophic decision. But, you know, when President Obama did something similar in terms of Osama bin Laden, everyone said, oh, yeah, that was the obvious decision. Well, no, it wasn't. It could have ended up like Jimmy Carter and Desert One.
It could have failed, too.
It could have failed.
When you make bold decisions, they can fail.
Well, you know the old saying that success has many fathers, failure is an orphan.
Right.
When you go back to Jimmy Carter, though, he was president or became president shortly after the oil crisis of 1973. Actually, he was not president, but he became president while that was still fresh in memory. He was very enthusiastic about trying to make the United States energy independent. He put solar panels, which at that point was a very expensive technology, extremely so. He put solar panels on the White House to be symbolic. He gave talks with what the Republicans started calling that, what was the term that they used? Not ennui. They used some other term that wasn't as French. Malaise. Yeah, it's sort of French. They talked about the Carter malaise speeches. But then, you know, they were so pro-consumption that when Reagan came into office, he not only didn't like the solar cells, he didn't even bother using them. He took them off. So the symbology there was not only don't we care about renewable energy, but we're not even going to worry about energy independence. At that point, I think that we were importing about 30% of our energy. Okay, Egberto is telling me I need to wrap it up here. I'm going to give
you
the last word,
time.
Cheryl. Do you want to say anything else? Because I've been talking a lot. Do you want to wrap it up and then
we'll
go?
No. I just wanted to make that point that I really think if democracy is going to be successful in any country, it's going to be driven by their own people.
It's a bottom-up process.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you in principle. Thank you so much for calling, Cheryl. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay, you have been mostly listening and not calling to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. I keep talking about this trans is the new gay, and I just don't understand why nobody wants to discuss it.
Get the message.
Oh, man. Okay. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week when I'll be asking for money. Please don't let that deter you. I'll try to be entertaining in the process. Have a great week. Take care.
You can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You can make a difference by donating something, whether it's moving or not. An old car, RV, motorcycle, tractor, or boat. To KPFT's vehicle donation program, whether we played your favorite song or helped you discover your new favorites, you listen because you enjoy KPFT's unique mix of sounds. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org to help now. Your tax-deductible donation before the new year gets you a KPFT membership and makes such a difference at a station that is the heart and soul of our community. So, just move to the phone and call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org, and we'll make it easy to donate to the nonprofit radio station that you love. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.